Hello, thank you for joining At the Root of It. This is Aaron Fitzpatrick broadcasting out of Roberta's Restaurant, Heritage Radio Network, on the 3rd of November. A thank you to our sponsor, Fairway Market, like no other market, www.fairwaymarket.com, where online you can order some lovely holiday baskets. And for our listeners today, please call in at 718-497-2128 with any thoughts or questions that you might have. So we'll begin today's program with the Week in Wine recap, and in latest news that, contrary to what was reported last week on the show, U.S. restrictions on Brunello di Montalcino will remain in place. The U.S. Trade Bureau has said that the TTB will continue to enforce the certification of importation of Brunello di Montalcino required and has no plans to lift this. And in the Croft Report, Germany's 2009 vintage is stated to be just as good as the 2007, but as the case with Italy, the 2009 vintage will be less. The crop will be lower. Ernst Bunzer of the German Wine Institute stated that the crop will be 10% less than last year due to early flowering, uneven flowering, and cold, rainy weather resulting in less and smaller grapes per bunch. And in the market feed, Amazon will sell no wine. Reported late last week, the giant internet retailer confronted too many logistical demands that it became unclear whether the risks outweighed the benefits. It's noteworthy that this is Amazon's second failed attempt to sell wine online. In 2000, it invested $30 million in WineChopper.com, but that .com fizzled when the financial crisis intervened. Let's see if Bon Appetit will have more luck with an online selling program for wine. And we'll return just after the break with Justin Christoph, rare wine and Riesling specialist and founder of Riesling AC. Creep on in, on in, on in. Oh, see, I'm riding high, high. Whoa. Kind of broke the ceiling, y'all. So all I got is fire. I got fire. Player, give me some brew and I might just chill. But I'm the type that likes to light another joint like Cypress Hill. I still do these spit loogies when I puff on it. I got some bucks on it, but it ain't enough on it. Go get the S-T-I-D-E-S. Nevertheless, I'm hella fresh, rolling joints like a cigarette. So fast across the table like ping pong. I'm gone, beating my chest like King Kong. And some wrap my lips around the 40. And when it comes to getting another stogie, fools all kick in like Shinobi. Know me ain't my homie to begin with. It's too many hands to be. Probably let my friend hit bit. Unless you pull out the fat crispy. Welcome back to At the Root of It with Aaron Fitzpatrick on the Heritage Radio Network. And a welcome to my guest this afternoon, Justin Christoph. How are you today?
Good, thanks. Thank you for having me here to talk about Riesling today.
Thank you. I just learned that you have founded a new website, blog, called Riesling AC.
Yes, I wanted to focus on Riesling as the world's greatest wine grape and to devote reviews and resources and other information for people to find it all in one spot and to generally promote Riesling and to show the different possibilities that are out there.
That's great. I feel like there's a huge appreciation and love for Riesling within the wine community, but on a larger, more commercial scale, it's a bit harder to reach.
Yes, I feel like we might be on the cusp. It's been a connoisseur or eclectic, like sommelier's pet wine for a number of years in Austria and Germany. And I think the larger consumer base is now, you know, coming onto that and realizing that there's a lot of possibilities for Riesling in their wine drinking and wine collecting.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a quick call from our a caller here. Hello,
yes,
caller,
sure.
Are you there?
Hi, I have a question for the Riesling doctor.
Yes. What is your question this afternoon? What's your name? I'm sorry.
Brian DeMarco.
Oh, hello, Brian.
Hi, Brian.
I recognize that voice.
It sounds very
Hi,
familiar.
Hi, Justin. Hi, Aaron. Well, my question is that, for both of you, is what do you think with the global warming and the prominence of Riesling coming on the global stage, what is what is the hopes of Canada and upstate New York for making more world-class, better Rieslings?
Good question.
Great question, yeah, because it's a very timely and ties into a lot of geopolitical larger issues of that the wine trade has to deal with. I think global warming can help Canada and upstate New York to a certain extent, as well as those regions just becoming more well-known. And the vines becoming older, I think, was like another problem with the quality of wines in those regions. So I think it could help in the short term, but at the same time, if global warming gets accelerated too quickly, then the vineyards may have to migrate further north, and it may destroy the acid balance, which is so important for Riesling. You need the high acid, especially with the sweeter Rieslings, to balance the wines. And besides getting warmer weather destroying that, you also need the difference between the cool nights and the warm days, and that temperature change is very important. So if that disappears, in addition to the global warming, it could be bad for Riesling in Canada and elsewhere.
Well, it's interesting that it seems that in the past couple of years, Germany has had some of the strongest vintages, reported vintagers, in the past 10 years, with the 07 and the 09, and the 08 was such a cool year that it became clear in the 08 vintage that they were very lean, very crisp wines coming out of Germany. Have you seen similarities with respect to the U.S. market and the regions that produce Riesling?
Yes, you would usually get only two or three good Riesling vintages a decade, and now you're getting 7 to 8 good mm-hmm. vintages. And a vintage like 08, which is considered a little bit leaner compared to the 07 and especially the 05 and the 03, which were very quite ripe.
Right.
Winemakers would have died 40 years ago for a vintage like 08 mm-hmm. because that's got great ripeness, great balance. It's just all relative to the increased warming climate changes and higher must weights, ripeness, and you're just getting bigger wines with more potential alcohol, whether that's results in sugar or alcohol, you know, it depends on the style of wine, but it's, mm-hmm. they're weighty wines.
Have you seen changes more in Germany from vintage to vintage than, say, in Canada or Long Island or Hudson Valley, Finger Lakes?
I think the vintages in Germany tend to be more dramatic.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say the same thing.
I would agree with that, yeah, absolutely.
Now, you just got back from Germany.
Yes, I was over there end of September for the famous wet auction. So it was a series of four auctions over 4 days in the different wine-growing regions. Each region has their own auction where they sell their best wines, and there's a tasting as well.
Mm-hmm. So can you define for our listeners what wet auction means?
They're wet because literally you get to taste every wine in an auction, which is a lot different than a U.S. or U.K. auction, where there might be a small pre-sale tasting of just a sampling of a few of the wines, whereas the Germans, in their pursuit of thoroughness, you taste every wine before the auction, as well as every wine during the auction. So you get to taste twice consistent notes, hopefully. And
that's a testimony to the quality of these wines. These men are very, and women are very proud of their wines and can really speak to saying, well, taste this. You'll be able to see for yourself if you'd like to.
Oh, absolutely. They're very proud. And the tasting's usually done in the morning is like a walk around tasting where each producer is at the table and can field questions and tell you why they made this specific special wine for the auction and why they chose it for the auction. And there's actually a review board that happens in the summer where the different wine commissioners and people prominent in the German wine trade get together and decide which wines finally get put in the auction from the ones that the producer suggests. So it's a fairly rigorous process.
Mm-hmm.
And
it sounded like it was a bit of a marathon as well with respect to each region hosting their own auction.
Yeah, they're about an hour and a half apart, and so there's a bit of...
Spanning over a couple days, or...?
Yeah, four auctions, 4 days, and usually there's a tasting from 9 to 11 in the morning, quick break for lunch and some repair beer, and then back to the auction in the afternoon, which there's usually only between 30 and 50 lots in each auction, which if you're used to a U.S. or U.K. wine auction, you say, well, that's great, you could get that done in a half hour, 45 minutes, but it's a longer process because it's you're tasting each wine.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes time for that to come out. And during that time, the auctioneer is speaking about the producer, his family, just saying general nice things, not too controversial or critical, but just kind of giving you a sense of the wine and why it was there. And from there, unlike a U.S. or U.K. auction, people can and the audience cannot bid themselves. You have to bid through a commissioner. So basically you sit at a long table and there's a commissioner at the end of the table and you give your bids to your commissioner and your commissioner competes with his groups of bids versus the other commissioners.
Mm-hmm.
And the auctioneer will eventually stop talking about the producer, how great he is and how lovely his wine is. And usually they have the producer sitting next to him. So he's there kind of like seeing his children, you know, graduate onto the world stage. And he'll start the bidding. And the wine commissioners, when they bid, are very discreet. They'll sometimes just bid with like one finger or a wink or a nod.
Spoken language.
And you're just looking around. You're just like, where are these bids coming from?
Sure.
It feels like phantom chandelier bidding. But
sounds a little bit like a Muay Thai boxing match to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a great cross-cultural way to put it.
Uh-huh. Well, I read recently that they were pretty well attended, these auctions, considering the economic climate.
There seems to be a lot of people there besides buying that just want to taste the wines because the tickets are only between 25 and 75 euros, and the wines that you're tasting, you know, vary from that price to several hundred euros a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And besides their price, they're very rare. These batches of wine they make are usually between 100 and 300 bottles.
Wow.
So there's very little. The tasting itself almost diminishes the supply, but by the time you figure that there's enough wine for a couple hundred people to taste, they're probably killing about a case or two right there.
And so who's making up the crowd that goes to these auctions?
It's mostly German right now.
But buyers, are they collectors? Are they trade?
Mostly trade, a few private people. But I say by and large, they're mostly trade because they are kind of marathon tastings. It's not like a casual cocktail tasting where 45 minutes to an hour, you're done.
Right.
And they are in fairly remote regions. They are in the wine growing regions. They're not in the big cities.
Mm-hmm.
So you do have to make an effort to get there. But there's a fair amount of journalists and private buyers as well. You don't need to be in the trade to buy, which is the great thing. And even though a lot of the lots of wines are 100, 300 bottles, you don't have to buy the whole lot. You can go to your commissioner and be like, I want one bottle
mm-hmm.
of that wine.
Mm-hmm.
And even though it only costs 10 euros, there's no minimum.
I love this.
That you
this
have to
fantastic.
Buy.
Fantastic. Yeah.
And so that's kind of a cool thing. So basically all the commissioners are bidding against each other. And then as the lot kind of, as the bidding slows down, they all huddle up like football officials reviewing a play. And you're just kind of wondering what's going on. It's almost like a bit of collusion, but they're trying to get a good price, a fair price for the wine producer, but at the same time get a fair price for their buyers that they're representing and compete against the other commissioners, but at the same time not screw the other commissioners out of getting any wine. So they'll kind of cooperate, and if there's 300 bottles, they may divide that lot up amongst four or five commissioners.
It's very German, very fair.
And one commissioner will become the lead commissioner who'll actually buy it, and then it's his responsibility to dole it out to the people
mm-hmm.
that are interested in it.
Have you heard of any other countries or regions doing something similar with respect to tasting and auctioning off wine?
Well, we were mentioning earlier on the way here, the Hospice de Beaune auction is the barrel auction run by the famous charity in Burgundy. And that's similar because the wine is coming directly from the producer. But it's different in that it's only one producer and that mm-hmm. it's all in barrel, whereas this has all been recently bottled. So it's a little more accessible, whereas if you buy a barrel, you have 25 cases to deal with, whereas here, where you're dealing with bottles, it's a little more democratic. And interestingly enough, the German wet auctions, when they first started, were very similar, selling wines in barrel, mostly to negotiants and producers of wines that wanted to bottle wines. But as more and more estates became estate bottled and doing their own production, the wet auctions evolved and from a barrel auction into a bottle auction and from selling all the wines to just the top wines. So basically at the wet auctions, you're dealing with Auslesen, Gold Capsule, Long Gold Capsule, which are the German designations for reserve and special reserve, and special Fuder or barrel numbers. If they find a special barrel or batch in their cellar that's a little bit different, they'll put Fuder number 14, and that was barrel number 14, literally. And also the very rare Eiswein from the frozen grapes and the Trockenbier and Auslese, the dried berries that make the honeyed, almost molasses-like dessert wine.
Excellent. Well, we are going to take a short break and be back to talk a bit more about Gold Capsule and just the statement that you made earlier, why Riesling is the best grape varietal. You're listening to At the Root of It on the Heritage Radio Network, and this is Erin Fitzpatrick broadcasting out of Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn, with my guest this afternoon, Justin Kristoff of Riesling AC, and a rare wine specialist as well. So we just finished up the previous segment speaking about the German wet wine auctions. Justin just returned back last month, and we brought up the idea of gold capsule wines, which are very small, precious wines, I believe, from German wine producers who release only at their discretion. And you were telling me a little bit about the gold capsule idea before the show, and if you could just touch upon that again, that would be great.
Absolutely. Gold capsule evolved after the 1971 wine law banned the term Feinst, which meant fine Auslese. The reserve Auslesen were called Feinst Auslesen. Prior to 1971, but after that, the German wine authorities wanted to level the playing field, so they didn't want any terms that couldn't really be legally enforced, because what really makes a fine Auslese is a subjective thing. So German producers came up with the ingenious idea of putting special gold capsules on their reserve bottlings, and they put a long gold capsule on the most special bottles to kind of get around the law and to tell the consumers, okay, this is the special wine. And a gold capsule can either be a later picking, or a special barrel that was found afterwards, after the winemaking process, to be have unique properties, or it could be a special parcel of the vineyard, usually the heart of the vineyard with the best exposure to the sunlight or the best drained soil that the winemaker feels that can make a special batch of wine.
And do we see many of them here in the States?
You see some drips and drabs, not too many. Mm-hmm. They're generally quite a bit more expensive than the standard Spätlese and Auslesen wines, and a lot of them do get bought and cellared and consumed in Germany, but there are some wines that do make it here, especially from J.J. Prüm, who's obviously a very famous maker of German wine, so there's some interest and demand for his wines at that price point. But from the other winemakers, I don't think a lot of the consumers have caught on yet.
Which brings up another interesting point about price. Given that the bulk of Riesling is really sold retail between $15 and $30, unless you're looking at some ice wine, which I think everyone who is looking for ice wine knows that it's
what they're
quite rare.
Into.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So there's a host of so many different wines at a higher price point that will age for years that I just don't think people really know about.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there. A lot of people are drinking more Riesling these days, but they're drinking that under $30 range, young, very casually. And that's perfectly fine to enjoy the upfront fruitiness of those wines. But there are the Auslesen and these Gold Capsule and Gros Gewächs, which is the dry Grand Cru. And those wines can age very well, 20, 30, 40 years, which is remarkable for white wines due to the acid sugar balance.
I'd say pretty much the only wines that can age that long.
Yeah, consistently. Yeah, it's
that I've had. I don't know. Maybe prove me wrong, but
the great thing about wine, there's always an exception. But
maybe Chateau Musard, you know, from '69, I had the other day, which was pretty impressive.
Yeah, Chateau Musard is a favorite of mine too, and they both the red and white Musard aged tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in Germany, there's been increased interest in these late special bottlings to age and sell at slightly higher prices that have unique characteristics similar to a Grand Cru Burgundy or a First Growth Bordeaux, whereas here in America and other countries, we're kind of trying to catch up a little bit,
So part of the Riesling AC, this website that you've created, www.riesling.ac, is about showcasing so many aspects of Riesling, which are fantastic, from these dry wines and versatility of the fruitiness of the younger wines to just the appreciation for the different levels of sugar that can exist and carry the Riesling through for many, many years. How do you look at Riesling as such a versatile grape in your point of view?
Definitely, you can make anything from a sparkling wine to a dry wine to an off-dry wine, a light wine, a mineral wine. It's a very transparent wine, so it really reflects its terroir. And so when you, even just in different spots in Germany, if you're going from red slate to blue slate to volcanic to different soils and different climates, it can show a lot of faces of itself. And Riesling.ac will also have reviews from Alsace and Austria and New Zealand.
Okay,
and
so you're
Canada.
you're tapping all areas.
The idea will be the appellation of Riesling worldwide. So we won't just, Germany will obviously be a focus as the homeland and the greatest, arguably the greatest producer of Riesling. But
more and more countries are experimenting with it as well.
Right, especially if you have an extreme climate that might not be suitable for other grapes. But it is, like, similar to Pinot Noir, it is very difficult to find just the right area. It's like the great thing about Chardonnay or Merlot is that you can make a pretty good one pretty much anywhere that's suitable for growing grapes, whereas Riesling and Pinot Noir being more terroir grapes are a little more sensitive and fickle to show their true colors because you're not really manipulating those wines as much with new oak. You're just kind of stuck with what the soil gives you, for better or for worse. Usually for better, hopefully.
And you were mentioning a historical aspect, which I thought was very interesting while we were on break, with respect to the auctions in comparison to Bordeaux and En Primaire, and what people in the past would pay for German wines in their cellars, comparatively speaking, to something like Lafite.
Right. Now, if you look at your average auction catalog, whether it's US, UK, or Hong Kong, there's one or two lots of Riesling here or there, German wines, and usually some old dessert wine, and that's about it. But in the 18th century and into the 19th century, some of the most expensive wines at Christie's and Sotheby's auctions were Rieslings, and they were a greater percentage of the auctions, and they were an important part of people's cellars. And it was the most expensive wine on the Titanic. So I don't know if that doomed the Titanic or not, but
there are a few wars in there, too, that I think probably disrupted that flow.
Yeah, the wars kind of hurt the PR a little bit, and to put it mildly. And German winemaking did have a focus post-World War II more on quantity rather than quality, and that changed in the 80s. And
that's where the Blue Nun came in with
the Blue Nun, the Black Tower, and also a lot of other wines, too, were just meeting the legal requirements, and that's it.
Right.
And then I think there was, in the late 80s, a new generation came in and realized, you know, we're with pesticides and machinery and weird grapes like Müller Thurgau and hybrids grapes that we can't pronounce too well, we're destroying German wine. So effort became to plant more Riesling, more hand-picking of the grapes, more biodynamic in the vineyards, and non-interventionist winemaking, and trying to exceed the legal requirements just to make a good wine, wherever it took, rather than be like, okay, we reached this sugar level, we can bottle it now.
Right. I was in Germany last April, and I noticed there are a lot more red wine, Spätburgunder, being planted in Germany. Did you find that at the auctions as well? Were you tasting more reds than whites this year?
One of the auctions has red wines, and that is the auction that has three regions in it. It has Rhine, Hessen, Nahe, and Ahr. And so there's a lot of Spätburgunders from the Ahr River Valley, which is actually the northernmost river in Germany, but it's a wine-growing region, but it's also one of the warmest, so it's ideal for Spätburgunder. And the wines were very good, and more remarkable to me were the prices. The bottles of German Pinot Noir were going over 100 euros a bottle, And this is basically a wholesale auction. So to the consumer, that's probably 150 euros and even more dollars to us by the time it gets over.
Absolutely.
So you're talking about Grand Cru quality wines. And but
what were some of the producers? Do you recall?
I've
had Frederick Becker, but I don't know that he would have been in that ring.
No, I don't
think. Faults.
I don't think he was this time. They're mostly from the R.
Yeah.
And Meyer Nackel and Deutscher Hoffer, and there were a couple other good producers as well. But generally, you don't see those wines very often here because there's a huge demand for German red wines in Germany. And they're so expensive that I think once you get to that price point, most Americans would rather drink Burgundy.
Burgundy, yeah. Right. So last question before we wrap up today's show, Desert Island, what are you taking with you? It doesn't have to be Riesling, but it sounds like that's where your heart's at.
Yeah, if it was just one Riesling, that would be difficult. It would be ideal just to say Riesling because you would cover yourself on so many bases. It's such a versatile grape. But I think I would... probably choose like an Auslesen that was aged, and to me those are the most versatile, complex, interesting wines because there's the balance between the sugar and the acid, and I think the terroir can really show in those wines, and they can age the longest, I think even longer than the Birnauslesen, Trockenbirnauslesen, because they have better balance and more purity. And as much as I love TBAs and BAs, I think I think after more than one glass, especially in a tropical climate, it would be a massive headache.
Well, not that you'd be eating a multi-course meal on this island, but I'd have to say the aged Auslesen go really well with food as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. They're very well balanced and very nuanced and very complex wines and deserving of more exposure.
Great. Well, for our listeners, be sure to check out Justin's website, again, www.riesling.ac, and hopefully we'll have a chance to meet again here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you to our producer and engineer today, Jack Inslee and Nat Wiener, and to our sponsor, Fairway Market. Thanks so much for joining us today.